All right, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:35 p.m. on Tuesday, February 24th, 2026. We're in the Al Adams Room in the State Capitol. Present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, the co-chair Neil Foster, co-chair Calvin Shragi, and myself, co-chair Andy Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lestefka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Zach Lawhorn, from the Legislative Information Office here. We are also joined by Representative Bynum. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, Callan Associates will present an overview of the Alaska Permanent Fund performance. Callan has served as the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's performance consultant for four decades. We are pleased to have Greg Allen, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Research Officer, and Steve Center, a CFA and Senior Vice President, with us today. CEO Allen and CFA Center, please come forward and put yourselves on the record and begin your presentations.
Good afternoon. For the record, Greg Allen at Callan. Thank you for having us up here. I think, Steve, if you could just advance the slide to the next slide. So this is kind of our agenda, but we're here to answer any questions that you have. So break in at any time, and if we have to go in a different direction than the slides, that'll be more interesting to me. But we're going to talk initially about the performance of the fund over various time periods, so Steve's going to focus on that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the asset allocation, how the assets are allocated, how we kind of get to the place, why they're allocated the way they are. And then we were asked for some of our thoughts on the draw rate from the fund. Mm-hmm. And so I've been involved with modeling lots of different things for the fund for the last 30-plus years. So I have a pretty good perspective on what, if you pull this lever or you move this lever, you know, what might happen. So we'll talk about the draw rate at the end of the presentation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Steve Center unless there are any questions.
Okay. Mr. Center, we've been joined by Representative Moore as well. Mr. Center.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Steve Center from Callan, Senior Vice President. I have worked with the Permanent Fund for about a decade now. Been with Callan for about 16 years, been in the institutional consulting industry for longer than I care to admit. I also happen to be the consultant on the Alaska Retirement Management Board. I work with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority as well. I know a lot about the Permanent Fund, but Greg is the brain around projections, so he will cover that. I'm going to spend my time just discussing the investment performance for the Permanent Fund for year-end 2025. Starting on slide four, we're just to help frame things. Our first couple slides look at capital markets performance. This is not the Permanent Fund's performance, but think of this as representing the benchmark returns to help us understand what the drivers were for the performance for the Permanent Fund as of year-end 2025. 25 was an interesting year. Non-U.S. stocks were the best performing asset class in the public market space. So on slide four, that green bar for last year, the Morgan Stanley Capital International All Country World ex-U.S. benchmark, which is a measure of non-U.S. stocks, including both developed and emerging market stocks, was up 32.4% last year. That's driven both by company performance but also by a weakening U.S. dollar. So when the U.S. dollar weakens, non-U.S. investments perform better. We saw very strong performance from non-U.S. stocks. U.S. stocks continue to do extremely well, though. The U.S. stock market was up 17% last year and has been the key driver of performance going back in the trailing years. So if we look out over the trailing 3, 5, 10-year periods, you'll notice that blue bar, which is the U.S. stock market, represented by the Russell 3000 benchmark, up 14% over the last 10 years. Very strong performance. The U.S. bond market last year was up about 7%, represented by the Bloomberg aggregate benchmark. But if we look at over the last 5 years, bonds really have been negative, and that's because interest rates went up post-COVID. When interest rates go up, bond prices go down. So we still have this longer-term time period where bond performance is actually slightly negative. We are seeing that begin to reverse with the Fed lowering interest rates three times last year.
Okay.
Slide five looks at private market performance. So the permanent fund doesn't only invest in stocks and bonds. It also invests in private equity, private credit, real estate, infrastructure, and hedge funds, a very customized version of hedge funds that's really focused on hedging out equity market risk where possible. So we have a couple benchmarks used here on slide five to represent those other asset classes. You'll notice the returns are not as high. This is the same scale as the previous slide, and the bars don't go all the way up into the 30s like the non-US stock market did last year. But these are designed to be diversifying asset classes to help minimize the volatility of the permanent fund over time. We saw pretty strong private market performance last year. Hedge funds up about 11%, infrastructure up about 10%, private credit and private equity both in the 7 to 8% range. Private equity has lagged public equity in the near term. When you invest in private equity, which is directly investing in non-publicly traded companies, you expect a return premium because of the lack of liquidity that comes along with that. So you expect private equity to outperform public equities, but that's typically over the longer term. So when we look out over 10 years and 20 years, you will really see that materialize, and we'll really illustrate that on the next slide.
Representative Galvin, question?
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair.
For Mr. Center.
No. This is a
sorry, for
question
Mr. Allen.
From Mr.
Go ahead.
Center,
Allen.
Yes.
Center, got it right.
Yeah, it's for Mr. Center.
Okay.
Thank you. So I wondered if you wanted to comment around the real estate piece. I'm seeing that on all of these, all the way last year, last 3 years, last 5 years, last 10 years, and last 20 years, all of them is showing significantly lower than the other parts of the portfolio. And maybe it needs to still be in place, and if you could give us more of that understanding of why it's there.
Correct. So the return index that we're using here is a benchmark published by a firm called NCREIF, National Council of Real Estate Investment Funds. And it tracks the performance of publicly investable, institutionally investable real estate funds that invest in things like office buildings, retail establishments, apartments, industrial spaces like warehouses and hotels, things like that. When COVID hit and interest rates went up, much like we saw bond prices come down, rising interest rates also is a headwind for valuations when it comes to real estate, because most real estate transactions are levered. They require borrowing in order to buy these buildings. So that lowers the price of real estate. Additionally, work from home became very popular. So office has really been hammered. And retail has also really been hammered. As a result, the lag of performance from real estate that you see, particularly over the last 3 years, has two big factors. So the office and retail factor, but also the rising interest rate factor. We still do see most institutional investors have an allocation to real estate within their investment program. And that is because it is an excellent diversifier versus particularly equity and fixed income over the long term. The permanent fund does invest in real estate. I believe their current target is 13%?
11.
I knew it was in the low tens. So 11%. That is, in our opinion, a good target for the permanent fund and for a program of that size. But you are correct that looking at with the current point in time, looking back, it looks like why did we invest in this asset class? It is there because it tends to zig when other asset classes zag, and it is a good diversifier to minimize volatility over time.
I do have a follow-up, and I think what I'm doing is really reinforcing what I just heard from you, which is it's something that is important to have in place because over the long, 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 long term, it is always a smart investment. Is that what I'm hearing? Because I can imagine someone who doesn't understand these numbers and is just looking at all of the different graphs that we have here on real estate, they might be saying, hey, maybe this is one area where we need to lighten up. But I just want to make sure I hear it from the two of you that actually it's not a good idea, because having real estate as a base portfolio piece that that most investors always keep in their portfolio. And I suppose if you wanted to comment on the 11% and how, if that's normal.
Mr. Center.
I will say that everything you just said is correct. That the reason it is in the permanent fund program, and it's in most large institutional investment pools, most public funds, most state-sponsored retirement plans, is because real estate tends to be a very good diversifier to particularly the public markets.
Through the chair, can I add one?
Absolutely.
Mr. Allen.
Thank you. Two other things about real estate that are nice. It generally does well in high inflation environments relative to other assets. So as you know, the permanent fund's goal is to beat the inflation rate by 5% to preserve purchasing power for future generations of the fund. So and there aren't a lot of assets that do well in inflation, but real estate is one of them. And real estate generally delivers income. So the stock market has some dividends. There's a little bit of income, but real estate actually delivers a relatively high amount of income. Income is an important ingredient for the permanent fund because it feeds the earnings reserve. So income goes directly into the earnings reserve. So higher income asset classes like bonds or real estate, they might have lower returns, but they have that added benefit of generating income, which feeds the earnings reserve through statutory net income.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Josephson. Mr. Center, you said with the first slide, and I just think it's worth repeating, because what I heard you say is these first few slides are not the permanent funds portfolio, but the overall market that you are showing us.
That is correct.
And so I just, because we were delving into how the permanent fund compared, and I think it's worth repeating that you're briefing us on the overall market before we delve into what our portfolio looked like. Additionally, I do have one specific question on slide 5 under infrastructure. Data centers are considered infrastructure, and I guess I'm looking to understand how they are measured as an infrastructure, because they're both an energy consumer, a water consumer, and so just helping me understand how they're linked into infrastructure as an investment versus private equity.
Correct. So infrastructure is a little bit of a in-between investment. And the reason I say that is there likely is some infrastructure in the real estate return that you see here. Some institutional real estate funds do invest in data centers. But data centers are also included in most infrastructure funds as well. Okay, so, and you are correct that data centers are consumers of energy and water. Most infrastructure funds also invest in things like energy generation, pipelines, energy transfer. So it is all interrelated to a degree. But this is still, I don't want to say it's an asset class that's in its infancy, because data centers have been around for quite some time, but they have just absolutely blossomed as an investment opportunity with the onset, in particular, of the AI boom that we're going through right now. So what used to be focused more on telecommunications and cloud computing is now expanding as well into AI. So we are seeing that grow as a portion of the infrastructure asset class.
Follow up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Just because I'm trying to understand data centers a little better, are most data centers, when you're buying them in a market, are, I guess I was always under the impression, like, and I'm just, you know, like Google had its own data center and Amazon had its own, but are there literally, you're buying stock or investing in a data center that is used by a variety of vendors? So you're not really buying, okay.
So oftentimes you are, there's actually construction of a data center that's ultimately bought or leased by Microsoft or Amazon or Google. But there are also private data centers that are servicing other, in particular, AI providers at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Stack.
Thank you, Chair Justin. I have two. One, the first one's quick through the chair. Just to clarify, when we talk about real estate, we're talking about physical real estate, not REITs, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, follow up.
At some point, and I don't know if there's a later slide that we can do this on, I'd like to kind of dialogue about kind of the private equity and the kind of change in philosophy from the permanent fund board and get your guys' thoughts, because it still appears that private equity is a pretty consistent high performer. But I know that there's later slides. We can probably talk about that through the chair.
We will address that question later in the presentation.
Let's push on. And I see that as deep as slide 49, there's some important information about, for example, it's entitled probability of shortfalls. That gets my attention. So
right.
We want to make sure that we have some pace to this. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Senator.
Acknowledgement, Mr. Chair. I'm going to flip ahead just really quickly. Slide 6 just looks at the 20-year performance for all of these asset classes, so strictly the longer-term performance. And you'll see that currently, private equity, as was just alluded to, is actually the strongest performer over the last 20 years, trailing, following immediately after with U.S. public equity, infrastructure, private credit. Particularly as the risk dials down, returns tend to dial down. That's the sort of expectation you would assume to see.
And just through the chair, the permanent fund owns all of these categories, so it's very diversified. And Steve's going to show you that sometimes they work at different times. So.
Right. And that's what slide 7 is. Slide 7 is what Callan calls our periodic table of market returns. This is a bit of an eye chart, so forgive us. But what this chart shows you is the individual calendar year return for each of those benchmarks. So you can see when that there is no winner that is the winner every year. You want to create a diversified portfolio that holds each of these asset classes over time so that you are not just holding an asset class that was the best performer last year and is ultimately the worst performer in the next year. You'll notice it's very rare for any of these colors to be at the top for every single year.
Okay.
The performance for the permanent fund is on slide 8. So this is the permanent fund's performance as of the end of 2025. At 12.5% return last year, did outperform its total fund target and the CPI plus 5 target. When we get out to the longer time periods over the last 3 years, the permanent fund has lagged its performance benchmark. This is the performance benchmark is a combination of the underlying asset class benchmarks that represent the sorts of investments that the permanent fund is making. But it has outperformed the CPI plus 5 target over the last 3 years. Over the longer time periods, 10 years, 20 years, 35 years, the permanent fund has outperformed its total fund target over the long term. So despite this near-term lag over the last 3 years, it continues to perform extremely well over the long term.
Okay. Slide 9.
Slide 9 looks at the permanent fund over a full 35-year period versus that CPI plus 5% target. This is just a way to show you that it's very difficult to invest in a way that matches CPI plus 5%. If there was a way to do it, I would invest in that all day long. But the goal of the permanent fund is to create an investment program that should keep pace with CPI plus 5 over the long term. You see on a couple areas that we have highlighted with arrows, particularly during market dislocations, things like the global financial crisis, like the dot-com bubble bursting or COVID hitting, there is volatility with the performance of any institutional investment program. But over the last 35 years, the permanent fund has kept pace with that CPI plus 5% target.
Okay.
We do have a slide here, slide 10, which shows you the value of determining your time period that you're using for your analysis. So rather than 35 years on slide 9, on slide 10, we're looking at the last 25 years. And because of that starting point, which is right before the dot-com bubble bursting, it looks like the permanent fund has not been able to keep pace with the CPI plus 5 target. So this is just a simple illustration to help help the committee understand the importance of recognizing the time period and the dependence on the time period that can impact the analysis of comparative performance.
Okay.
The last couple slides I have to touch on compare the permanent fund's performance versus peer groups. Slide 11 compares the permanent fund versus other large public funds. So these are large retirement, state-sponsored retirement systems. with assets over $1 billion. Recognizing that the permanent fund is not a retirement system, it is currently invested more like an endowment. Historically, if you look back 20 years ago, the permanent fund was structured and invested far more like a retirement system, with more in public equities and less in private markets. So we do compare the permanent fund against two different peers. In this case, the permanent fund has outperformed the median peer over the trailing 5, 10, and 20-year periods. Slide 12 compares the permanent fund versus large endowments and foundations. So I mentioned that the permanent fund currently invests in a program that is fairly similar to how endowments, large endowments and foundations invest, with less in public equities and more in the private markets. So the near-term performance of the permanent fund is a bit more like endowments and foundations, but it does have a little more in fixed income than most endowments and foundations do, and that's because of the income generation from the bond investments and how income can ultimately benefit the permanent fund over time. So you will see on this chart that the permanent fund falls below median over the last 5 years, but over the full 10 and 20-year periods is very close to the median performance of a larger endowment or foundation.
Okay. Yes, Rep. Stamp for Mr. Center.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. Just curious, when you measure these, do you measure fee structure?
So this analysis is compared on a gross of, I say gross of fee. It's gross of fee for the public market managers. All public market investments are tracked net of investment management fees. What we do, Callan on a semi-annual basis conducts a full investment management fee study of the entire institutional marketplace that we share with all of our clients and we share directly with the permanent fund. I will say that the permanent fund's cost structure, they are among the most aggressive with their investment managers in driving down the cost of management fees. They're very, very good at doing so. And then on top of that, they manage their entire fixed income portfolio in-house. So they are not hiring external asset managers for 20% of the underlying permanent fund. So they are extremely focused on keeping costs low.
Through the chair, one more comment. The returns,
it's Mr. Allen.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. The returns that we're showing for the permanent fund are all net of fees. So this is after all the fees have been taken out.
Okay, that was the question. Thank you.
Okay.
The last two slides I have look at risk, so not just returns, but also volatility of the permanent fund versus those same two peer groups. So slide 13 compares the permanent fund versus large public funds. Over the last 10 years, the second bar represents standard deviation, which is a measure of overall volatility of returns, realized volatility of returns over time. The permanent fund has exhibited a lower volatility level than most public funds. Most public funds tend to hold more in public equities, which are more volatile by nature because they are marked to market every minute. Sharpe ratio, the bar on the far right, measures how, think of this as a measure of return per unit of risk, how effective the risk that is being taken is resulting in performance. What you see here is exactly what you want to see, low volatility versus peers and a high Sharpe ratio. So the risks that are being taken are being rewarded by the permanent fund. You see a very similar pattern on 14 versus the endowment peer group. Slightly higher standard deviation, but still below the median observation, and a higher Sharpe ratio above the median observation over the trailing 10 years. I'm going to stop there for any questions about the permanent fund's performance before I pass things to Greg Allen.
Yes, Co-Chair Shragi for Mr. Center.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Can you square the better performance on the Sharpe ratio with maybe slightly below average performance when compared to public funds and large endowments on slides 11 and 12?
So as a reminder, this is looking at 10 years. So over the last 10 years, the permanent fund, if we look at slide 13, the return bar is that one on the far left. The permanent fund is in the 33rd percentile versus peers. So it is, you know, a good 70% of large public funds have underperformed what the permanent fund has done. It's very, very strong. The endowment and foundation peer group on 14 over the last 10 years, it is a slightly below median outcome. But the lower risk is resulting in a higher return than peers who have taken on more risk. So the Sharpe ratio ultimately looks very strong. The risks that are being taken are being implemented and resulting in stronger returns than most peers, than a good 60% of peers.
Thank you.
Representative Sharpe. Staff for Mr.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Just to piggyback on the co-chair's question, would we expect a higher percentile if we were to structure our fund more similar to an endowment, since we're basically have a two-account structure currently, to the chair?
Mr. Senator,
Can I?
You can chime in.
Or Mr. Allen.
Yeah. All right. So the
Mr. Allen.
I don't think whether it's a one-account system or a two-account system is going to change fundamentally the way that it's managed. I think of the two-account system as being an accounting layer that sits on top of the management of the fund, which is being managed to generate the highest return per unit of risk. So they don't think about the two-account system when they're investing the assets. The two-account system, and we're going to talk about this, has a potentially a huge impact on what the legislature can appropriate, depending on the health of the ERA. So it could have an effect on what comes out of the fund, but it doesn't necessarily have an effect on how the fund is managed. I think the fund is managed fundamentally to try to beat CPI plus 5. Now, on a day-to-day basis, they're trying to beat their performance benchmark because that's you know, the passive way that they could be investing. But the amount of risk that they take is driven by the long-term goal of the return that's needed. And so, you know, when especially since 2018, when we flipped over to a POMV, in order to preserve the purchasing power of the fund over the long run, it needs to earn CPI plus 5. That covers the draw, and that allows the principal to grow by inflation. And so that's the driver. The draw is the driver. The two-account system is not the driver of the way it's managed.
Co-Chair Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. On that, is that true that it has no impact on investment decisions? I just vaguely remember a prior presentation in maybe the last 2 or 3 years, that because of concern over the ability to meet the cash needs of the state, that there was some maybe distant but nonetheless some impact on their investment decisions. Is that incorrect?
Mr. Allen.
Through the chair, I would say that they absolutely do not change the way they manage the fund to affect statutory net income. Okay, so I believe that, well, I've been around this fund now, again, since about 1990 and very directly involved since the early 2000s. In the early 2000s, there was a moment in time where the ERA, they entered the year and the ERA was essentially zero. There was some concern they couldn't even pay. That was back when it was just the dividend, you know, so it was a much smaller draw. And I remember there being allegations that they jacked up the turnover so they could realize a bunch of gains. So this would have been in like 2004 or 2005. But I can't verify that that ever happened. But I know that since that time, that is the third rail from an investment standpoint, to like alter the investment process just to make sure there's statutory net income. That's not managing the fund necessarily in the interest of generating the highest return per unit of risk, which is their fiduciary responsibility. That's a second order objective. Now, if the legislature were to pass legislation requiring them to realize gains at a certain emergency moment, they obviously, I think, have to do that. But their mandate is very clear. It's the prudent person mandate, which is to manage for the total return and not to try to generate extra income just to feed the earnings reserve.
One more follow-up.
Yes, follow-up. Co-Chair Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. If there were to be a cash crunch, I thought I recalled the Permanent Fund Corporation saying that they would recognize the role that it plays with the state and try to meet the cash needs of the state. What is your understanding of the Permanent Fund Corporation's policy if there were to be a deficit within the earnings reserve, not enough to meet that 5% draw, how would they react according to your understanding?
Mr. Allen.
That's a tough question because, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure, right? I think their mandate and the board's mandate, and they're clear on this, is to manage the fund for total return. So my understanding is that they, unless they were told that they had to realize, because essentially what you do in that situation is you have to sell a bunch of stuff. And if you have to sell a bunch of stuff in an emergency situation, you're going to get lower prices. So that's going to hurt the long-run return of the fund. And the winners are going to be this generation of people that might get a higher payout in that year. So it does conflict with their fiduciary obligation to run the fund just to feed the ERA. But, you know, obviously you guys are the legislature, and I think ultimately you can influence them, but I think it would have to be through legislation and not just, like, somebody going down there and leaning on Devin.
Thank you.
Mr. Senator, how does broad scope the permanent fund's investment portfolio compare to the ARM board's, and which performs better?
That is a great question, and you're never going to believe this, but I looked this up this morning just to check. You can see here on slide 14 that the permanent fund returned 9.02 for the last 10 years. The ARM board returned 9.03%, and I'm not making that up. It's one basis point higher. It is implemented quite differently. The ARM board has far more in public equities. I say far more. It's like got about 10% more in public equities. It has much less in private credit and private equity. So its volatility is higher, about 8.9% versus the 7.4% that we see for the permanent fund. But its Sharpe ratio is also pretty positive, about 0.77, so above median. It's two different paths to a similar place, clearly, from a performance standpoint, but they're also managed, as I mentioned, very differently. The permanent fund is designed for a 5% real draw each year. The ARM board's program with the PERS and TERS and the judicial retirement system is those are closed pension plans. So it has a set liability that should have another life of 24-ish years, 22, 24 years. So it has a finite liability. It's managed in a very different way. So similar building blocks, but a different management style.
You said 24, 25 years. I thought it was 15 years.
I'm going off the top of my head, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right.
So my apologies if I did misstate.
Okay, let's push on then.
I'm going to pass things to Greg to talk about our capital market expectations.
All right. It might be easy if I took the mouse just because I'm – all right. So originally we were planning to talk about the whole capital market projection process and then – get to the draw. I think the draw is much more relevant to you guys than how the sausage is made over at the permanent fund in terms of why they invest in all these asset classes. But maybe as a high level overview, Callan, as their consultant, we do this on behalf of hundreds of clients. Every year we kind of look out into the future and try to predict over the next 10 years how the capital markets are going to behave. What's their expected return? What's their expected volatility? What's their expected correlation to one another? We come up with these numbers, and we put them all together, and we help our clients build what we call efficient portfolios, so well-diversified, maximized expected return per unit of risk. So every year we go through this. We've been doing it since I started in '88. That was my first job at Callan. What we do every year with the permanent fund is we take their strategic asset allocation, we overlay it on these expectations, and we give them an idea of what they can expect to return over the next 10 years. So it's a forward-looking process. All right, so this big ugly table is essentially the risk and return projections for all the asset classes that the permanent fund is invested in. And at the very bottom there, it says total fund. Our expectation, the middle of a range of potential outcomes, is that the permanent fund is going to return 7.3%. So they've got kind of a 50% chance of returning more than that and a 50% chance of returning less than that annualized over the next 10 years. We expect inflation to be about 2.5%. Okay. So what that means is there's a slightly less than 50% chance, we think, that the permanent fund will generate CPI plus 5. CPI plus 5 would be a 7.5% return. So in all the years I've been doing this with the permanent fund, you know, our expectations move around. Their asset allocation moves around. But they're always right around, you know, CPI plus 5 in terms of the projected return. And that's what I mean by that's how they manage the fund. If they were way behind, if this was like a 6.8, they would have to take on more equity or take on more private equity and get rid of fixed income, which comes at the cost of, in a crisis situation like the global financial crisis, that means they're going to go down by more. They have more volatility. So they're always looking to the volatility side and trying to get the return that they need with the least amount of volatility. So that's the asset allocation process. And the way you do that is by having a bunch of good ingredients like this and then executing well in every one of those buckets. And the permanent fund has been able to do that. They have one of the best private equity programs in public fund world in America. They've been doing it a long time. They're really good at it. Their infrastructure program is great. The absolute return program is great. I mean, across the board, this is a kind of gold standard, well-managed institutional program. The only thing this chart was designed to show is just there's a relationship between risk and return. So if you want more return, that's the y-axis, the vertical axis. You got to take more risk, which is the x-axis or the horizontal axis. Those are all the asset classes that are building blocks. You can see the APFC portfolio up there nice and high. It's above a lot of the other asset classes that have the same amount of risk, and that's because it's diversified. It's not just invested in one of those things. It's invested in all of those things. And when you put them together like that, that's the power of diversification. This is just a chart that shows how we've done over time in terms of our capital market projections. So basically, the orange line is what we thought would happen over the next 10 years, and the blue line is what actually happened over the next 10 years. And then the green lines on the outside is one standard deviation. So this is just a chart to say our projections work most of the time. They're pretty close to the orange line. But when you have a period like 2008, back in 1999, we thought this portfolio would do something around 8%, and it actually ended up doing 2%. When you have two global financial crises in one 10-year period, you're not going to make that expectation, and that's the big risk to an institution like the permanent fund. I'll skip that chart because it's complicated. So here is the permanent fund's target portfolio right now. All right, they have 11% in real estate. Well, first I'll start with the public markets. 20% in public fixed income. All right, that generates yield. That's the anchor to windward. That's the thing that goes up when the equity markets go down. Public equities, 32%. That's a global portfolio. It's about 65% U.S. equity and 35% non-U.S. equity. They've got absolute return. Those are hedge funds. It's a low-risk hedge fund strategy designed to diversify equities. They've got infrastructure and private credit. Those are high-yielding private asset classes, real estate, and private equity. So that's their current target.
Bynum. Mm-hmm. Representative Bynum for Mr. Allen.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair to Mr. Allen. Specifically, when we look at things like the real estate allocation, the 11% that we have on that, is that direct ownership of real estate, or is this an investment into more of a collective type fund that's real estate in nature?
Mr. Allen.
It's both, actually. So I'd say the bulk of it, probably of the 11%, probably around 7% is direct. They own some big direct, like a mall, for example, or a building in New York City. They have a lot of investments in funds, in commingled funds with various types of strategies to kind of fill around in that. And then they have an allocation to REITs as well. So those are the publicly traded real estate securities. So it's kind of a blend of both the approach, direct ownership, funds, and publicly traded REITs, as well as a very well diversified, you know, got retail, it's got industrial, it's got commercial office. It's, you know, it's got pretty, you know, every slice of real estate in there.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So these charts probably. So I guess, does this go back? Can you go back one slide for me, Steve?
Click one more time.
So the permanent fund, this is that same, this is looking forward, and this is return on the vertical axis and risk on the horizontal axis. But this is kind of our forward-looking view. The blue line is like the most efficient portfolios that you can get, given the building blocks that the permanent fund has. They're basically sitting right on the blue line, saying there's nothing they could really do from an asset allocation standpoint to be more efficient. If they were just invested in stocks and bonds in a 70-30 mix, that portfolio is expected to generate the same risk but a higher return. So the permanent fund portfolio is going to have a higher return but about the same risk of a 70-30 portfolio. What I wanted to show you on this next slide was this is the trailing 10-year, the blue line is the trailing 10-year return on a 70-30 portfolio. The orange line is that CPI plus 5. And what this tells you is that if you invest kind of like the permanent fund about 65% of the time since 1926, you would have been ahead on a 10-year look back, and about 35% of the time you would be behind. So as Steve said, if there was an investment out there where you could get inflation plus 5%, everybody in the world would invest in that. You can't get that without this kind of volatility. There are going to be times when the permanent fund trails CPI plus 5, and sometimes it's going to look pretty bad over the 1, 3, 5, 10, 15-year period relative to that benchmark. It's a hard benchmark to beat. All right. And that's – I don't know that I need to go over that slide or that slide. All right. So now we're on to the draw, unless there are any other questions about asset allocation.
Please, a question from Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and to the Chair, to Mr. Allen or Mr. Center, either way. We talked a lot about how they're doing asset allocations, and you know, we didn't specifically talk about if there's been any kind of exploration or looking into direct investment in Alaska. I was just wondering what your thoughts might be on that, even if it meant a smaller return. What kind of a then in turn impact would that have in, you know, Alaska economy, communities, those types of things?
Right,
Mr. Allen.
Thank you. All right, this is a big topic. They actually did launch a very small in-state investment program a number of years back. They basically capped that, and they're not adding to it anymore. They are allowed to invest in Alaska, so that's an important thing to know. But because they're subject to what's called the prudent man standard as fiduciaries, it has to generate as good or better return than they could earn somewhere else for the same type of risk. If I look out across the U.S. at funds like the Alaska Permanent Fund, you know, that were created through some form of either mineral wealth or, you know, there are other types. I look at them as kind of, there's kind of two categories. One, it's an economic development fund, and its purpose is to take that windfall and invest it back into the state to be able to create future value for the state, right? And so those funds are generally 100% allocated to projects within the state. The other model is the permanent fund model, where essentially they're trying to create a renewable resource for the state by generating the highest return per unit of risk so that the thing can be sustained forever. So their job is to just look for the highest return. And if it happens to be in Alaska, great. If it doesn't happen to be in Alaska, then they're going to move on. You know, at the end of the day, it's the state's money, and they have to decide what they want to do with it. But I can tell you the economic development funds do not last. Hopefully their projects do for the state, But they don't last forever like the permanent fund is designed to do, because you're inevitably, if you focus on a single geography, you're missing out on the entire rest of the economic system globally. And that comes typically at a huge cost. There are also political elements that I think economic development funds have to deal with, which make it very difficult to generate the same types of returns. So I guess I'll stop at that. But at this point, the permanent fund has a very clear mandate. They can invest in Alaska. They have invested in Alaska. But it's got to be just as good of a return producer as anything else that they have to look at.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that response. I think that the reason I'm asking the question is a lot of times we talk about this investment in Alaska and that it can happen. But when we, and it's probably a policy question and direction, but when we say that, for example, we're going to invest in a energy-producing facility as an example, and we're going to get back some kind of a return on that, 3%, 4%, 5%, whatever it is, and then maybe you can then make that investment somewhere else, like in Washington State, where you're going to get maybe a little better of a return on that investment. The difference is that when that investment is being made here in Alaska, we might see a savings to the ratepayer on the hundreds of millions of dollars or more.
Right.
So there is a direct benefit to our citizens, whereas that investment in Washington State is a direct benefit to the citizens of Washington. So I think that maybe it's a bigger conversation for what we have time for today, but it definitely is something that I think that we really need to be exploring and looking at, because it can have a cascading effect to have a positive impact on our economy.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair to our wonderful Callan folks. So just a quick dialogue here on private equity. So I was reading comments from Chief Investment Officer Frampton about kind of the board philosophy, and he kind of made a comment that the Permanent Fund Corporation is looking to scale back on private equity investments in terms of breakdown of the portfolio. A couple of reasons he gives. Number one would be hasn't been our targets, basically, we've not met. And the other comment he meant is there's really just too much capital chasing too few investments. And I'm curious what your guys' take on that and the impending kind of restructuring of the asset allocation through the chair.
I'll take that one through
sure.
the chair.
Mr. Allen.
So, first off, any change that's being contemplated by CIO Frampton is on the margin. So he's not suggesting that they get out of private equity. Up until last year, I think the target for private equity has just sort of marched upward. For the last 15 or 20 years, it's now at 18%, I think, of the fund. Before he even came to the permanent fund, he worked for a private equity shop. He's been underwriting private equity investments for over 20 years. So he has a really good perspective on looking at a deal and seeing what the price is and seeing what the value is. So one of the observations he's made is that it's different than it was 20 years ago. You're getting paid less than you were before. And I think that's true. I think that's generally recognized in the industry. And so what that should mean is that going forward, your returns relative to back then, your return expectations are lower, and yet they're still asking you to lock up your capital for the next 15 to 17 years. So I think what he's doing and what his job is to do is taking his experience, his knowledge, and on the margin, steering this battleship, right? This doesn't mean that they're going to sell all their private equity or they're going to get out of private equity. In fact, they're going to continue to have to allocate to private equity even if the target gets reduced. So nothing's been ratified by the board. There are board members that are much more bullish on private equity. And at the end of the day, the board decides what the asset allocation is. The staff will recommend and the board will decide. So this is going to be taken up in May. So at this point, nothing's changed, but Marcus has signaled that if they were going to move in a direction, he'd rather slow down on allocating to private equity and generally be in the public equity markets where there's more liquidity, so that if they ever did have to fund a big draw, you know, the money's there.
Follow up, Mr. Kutcher.
Yes, follow up, Representative Staff from Mr. Allen.
Yeah, so, I mean, what I read, the comment was in trying to get back to basics on private equity from him. I'm curious, in your professional opinion, if the objective is to free up the liquidity of capital by not having it in 10, 15-year ROI investments and look for more liquidity, is that more draw-related or is that more investment allocation?
That's
ROI-related, through the chair.
Through the chair.
Mr. Allen.
I would argue that's, and he actually said this yesterday in our meeting, that it's investment-related. So one of the important tools that he has and that he's obligated to use is rebalancing. So when the equity markets go up and the bond market either stays flat or goes down, he sells equities and puts the money into the bonds. Okay, and that's where you get the value of diversification. If you do that in a disciplined manner over time, you kind of get a free lunch out of that. It's really the only free lunch in investing. You're buying low and you're selling high. You can't do that in the private markets. If real estate goes up and equities go down, you can't sell real estate, because if you go out and try and sell something under duress, you're going to take a lower price. You can't capture rebalancing benefit. So on the margin, having a little bit more liquidity, i.e. money in public markets, which you can sell at any minute of the day and not typically impact the price very much, has value. And so that I think, was his strongest argument yesterday. And again, it's still a debate at this point. They may not change the target, but I want to be clear. I think what they're proposing is that it's 18% in private equity now, and over the next 3 years, it would be taken down 1% per year. So it's not a big sea change. I think what's unusual and why it picks up a lot of press is that he's doing this at a time where a lot of other big funds who started much later in private equity are moving in. And so the press is like, oh my God, it's the canary in the coal mine situation. If Marcus Frampton is getting out, and our industry press loves that stuff. So I think it's getting probably more press than, there's more smoke than fire or whatever. All right.
Let me ask you about your understanding of the permanent fund vis-a-vis the Alaska Gas Line. And this relates to what Representative Bynum asked about and how we define what is of value to the people of Alaska. And, of course, it directly relates to the prudent investor rule. But I guess the mystery element in it is we have our right under the plan to invest in 25% is exclusively our right. And that must have value, too, because no one else shares that right with us. Do you have any comments on my thoughts and also, I mean, relative to the whole of the corpus, the investment that would be called on is fairly modest. But I don't know if cash is available for that. And I don't know, under present rules, we couldn't direct that happens. We could suggest it, I guess.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
So, through the chair, a couple things. And I'm somewhat new to this idea of the liquefied natural gas line. But we have had some discussions about it. So first off, they would have to, if they were going to invest in it and it was not because of the pressure of the state of Alaska, they would do what's called an underwriting. So there would be an entire process and they would have to hire experts that understood these investments, and they'd look at the pros and the cons and the risks and everything else and decide whether it's a good investment. And I think that path is still available. Nothing about this being in Alaska forecloses them from doing that. They would want to size it appropriately. So this would be sort of an infrastructure investment. I think right now they have, I don't know, about $3 billion in total infrastructure investments. So I don't know how that would fit, and I'm not sure what everybody's suggesting the size of this would be. But to have your entire infrastructure portfolio in one investment would be hopelessly undiversified, right? So it could be a complement to the other infrastructure investments. So first off, there's a way it could be done. But again, they're going to make the decision. And third most, probably the most important thing, and I should have said this when I talked about investing in Alaska generally, the permanent fund itself does not do direct investing without some kind of third party involved in the process, and 99% of their investments are through an investment manager. So delegate those decisions to somebody else, monitor them, and that way the permanent fund staff is not involved directly in the investment process. So that's the way the business is done over there, 99% of the business. So investing in a pipeline, for example, the cleanest way to do it would be to hire somebody and have them make the decision, and then it's not on staff. There's another way you could do this, though, and I'm going to get attributed to this because it just came to me. But and luckily, I'm on a flight to California tomorrow, so I don't have to worry. But if the legislature decided that they wanted to invest in this thing, the cleanest way to do it would be to appropriate the money out of the ERA.
Why would you say this?
And invest it, because now you're not messing with the permanent fund's business. They remain independent. You're not forcing them to make investment decisions that they wouldn't make otherwise. So, you know, I'm not recommending that you do that, but I think that in some ways, from a governance standpoint, that's a lot cleaner than trying to pass legislation to force the permanent fund to be this thing that's kind of halfway in between a prudent person fiduciary and an economic development fund.
Okay. Thank you.
That was okay.
All right.
I suspect you could stay another day with that answer.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's go to slide 29. We're there. 30.
All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the draw. Just to level set, this is the way the draw is calculated now based on the statute. Those blue bars are the trailing 6 years of market value. The one on the right is the market value as of the end of 2025. Just as a quick update, we're already up to over $90 billion, by the way, in this far into 2026. So the way the draw is calculated is you go back to the first five of those years, you take the average of those market values, so looking back in the past, and then you apply the 5% to that. So I think one important note on the 5% draw rule, which I love about it, is two things. First off, it's a five-year average, so that's much less volatile than year-to-year market values. Smooths that out. You look back an extra year, and that helps because you know what the draw is basically a year in advance. So the government knows what they're going to be able to get. That's super helpful. So it's a great formula. But the third thing is that when you take that 5% and you multiply it by that average, when the market's going up, it actually works out to smaller than 5%. So the effective draw, based on the current market value at the end of 2025, for the permanent fund, is about 4.5%. Okay, so in generally, in up markets, that relationship means that you could earn a little less than 5% over CPI, and you can still keep up, because you're actually only paying out 4.5%. The average over time, given our capital market, is about 4.6. So 5% draw, based on the formula, and the lag translates to 4.6. So that's just something to keep in mind, which makes us all feel better that, you know, the permanent fund is set up to protect future generations as well as make the draw over time. All right, so that's the current draw. This is another perspective on the draw. This is what has actually been taken out of the permanent fund every year since 2001. So this is the actual draw. And so for most of that period, it was just paying the dividend, right? This doesn't take into account inflation proofing. This is the actual money that's flowing out of the fund. So you can see up until 2018, the average draw rate was about 2.3%. Okay. Now what's important about that is that over that time, the permanent fund beat CPI plus 5, which means that the fund was saving more than just inflation. It was getting oil revenue, that's protected, and it was saving more than just inflation. So that's what has gotten us to a place where it's able to fund 66% of the state budget was the fact that it had a low draw for a really long time, and nobody ever messed with it, thanks to the dividend. All right. Now I'm going to get a little deep here. So if you're not a numbers person, I apologize in advance. But what I did is I built a little model that allows me to go back to 2001 and apply the POMV draw formula as if it had started back in 2001 and overlay that with the two-account system, because I have all those values going back to the early 90s, and track what would have happened if you'd had a 4% draw formula starting back in 2000. So what this chart shows you is under a 5%, the current formula, 5% of the first five of the last 6 years, the orange bars are what that formula would tell you you could pay out. The blue bars are what you could actually pay out based on the value of the earnings reserve and the statutory net income. Okay? So what this chart shows you is that in most years, you could pay out the full draw. But there were some years where the starting ERA balance was so low and or the statutory net income was so low that you couldn't afford to pay the draw. Now, this also assumes that they were inflation proofing based on the formula, not ad hoc inflation proofing, but like following the formula. So the inflation proofing is eating into the ERA, and so is the draw. So you can see in 2009, you would have not been able to pay any draw, right? So if the state was dependent on the draw at that moment in time, you would have had to take a year off and then start again the next year. And the next year, you'd only get about half the draw because it took a while after 2009 for the ERA to get built back up. Happened again in 2024. Back in 2004. So there were a couple episodes, 04, 09, 10, 12, 13, 14, and 24, where you wouldn't have been able to pay the full draw. So that's a 5% draw, the effectively 4.6 that I talked about draw rule. Any questions on that? Okay. This is the same exact simulation. The only thing I changed is I dropped the draw down to 4.5. Okay. Still a rough little moment there in 2009, 2010, and a little bit of a hiccup in 2013. But the ERA was robust. All the inflation proofing, for the most part, was getting done. And the ERA was robust, more or less, to a 4.5% draw. Okay, so this tells you that under the current two-account system, and again, this happens to be, I think, a pretty good 25-year stretch of returns, other than 08 and 02. So the first half wasn't great. The second half was awesome. 4.5% is sustainable with not a lot of volatility, interruptions, you know, taking the year off. 5% starts to really push the limits of what the two-account system can handle. I'm going to make a comment about that, but I know at some point, somebody recently told me that somewhere up here on the hill, somebody suggested a 6% draw. So I just figured I'd show you what that looks like. And you can see that over the long run, you end up actually paying out a little more than you did under the 5% draw. It's like $1 billion more of cumulative draw. But you had a lot of rough years. So under the two-account system, the bigger the draw, the more comes into play the exhaustion of the ERA and a limit on the ability to spend. And 4.5 seems better than 5.
Mr. Allen, on slide 32, the payment of the dividend would have been compromised earlier. I mean, if for no other reason, political discussion about it would have been begun much sooner, right?
So this, I think that's right. I guess this is a good point that Devin actually made. This is a model, and models are useful, but they're always wrong, right? So the system of the legislature appropriating from the ERA creates some flexibility that this model doesn't have. Right? If there was money left in the ERA and there was an inflation-proofing bill to be paid, the model pays it even if it takes the ERA to zero. The legislature might say, well, we're going to take a year off from inflation-proofing just to create some cushion. So if you're willing to give up inflation-proofing at critical points, you probably could have avoided 2004. 2009 was an unavoidable problem for the system because you ended 2008. It was a horrific year. You were down, 30% or something like that. So basically, that alone wipes out the ERA. And then in 2009, because of the natural turnover of the fund, instead of realizing gains, you're realizing losses. And a realized loss offsets income as a negative. So the statutory net income in 2009 was actually negative. It was $2.9 billion negative. So there was nothing there to help you. It only hurt.
Okay. We have three questions. First from Representative Tomaszewski, and then we'll proceed. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Jefferson. I like simulations. Thank you for these. Always good to stimulate the mind. You don't have the balance of the corpus on these over this amount of time. Where does the corpus land at the end
at the
of
end?
This? Yeah, exactly.
We do have that.
In regards to these.
You're a great straight man. All right. So this slide shows you where we would be today in 2025, or fiscal year 2026, under what we did, what you all did, which is the historical. So we're at $85 billion. That's the total value of the fund. Under the 4.5% draw, you'd be at $71 billion. 5% draw, you'd be at $68 billion, 69. And the 6% draw, you'd be at $66 billion. And one of the reasons they don't look as far apart as you would think, you'd think you'd be even worse off with the 6% draw, but the reason you're not is because the ERA limited you from spending 6%. So you didn't spend the full 6% because the ERA kept cutting you off, right? So it's a lot closer to the 5% than it would be without the ERA. But you can see those are the other kind of important balances there. You know, you'd be sitting on an ERA balance right now of $970 million, right? One that I think is pretty interesting is I think the distribution in 2025 was $3.6 billion to the state. If you had done the 4.5% draw this whole time, because the market value was so much lower, or let's look at the 5% draw, because the market value is so much lower than $85 billion, you would have only delivered $2.9 billion to the state. So about $600 million difference just based on that lower market value. So,
and a follow-up on that.
Yeah. Representative Tomaszewski, follow-up for Mr. Allen.
Thank you. Through the chair. So have you run the simulation of what it would be if we had not gone to the POMV draw and we had just stayed with the statutory draw on the permanent fund?
Mr. Allen.
I'm thinking that the number is going to be a lot bigger.
Yes. So I think that if you can take anything away from this session, and this affects both your personal life and your professional life, the less you take out, the more you'll have at the end. And the power of compounding, compound returns, the fact that they slope up like that, magnifies that significantly, right? So one of the things if we don't have time to get to it, I want to make sure I say this. I have some modeling that I've done kind of looking out into the future under a 4.5%, a 5%, a 6% draw. If you were to take 4.5% for 12 years, and you compare that to taking 5% for 12 years. In that 13th year, the dollar value of the 4.5% draw will actually be higher than the dollar value of the 5% draw because the market value is higher. Wow. So basically, you have a crossover point where if you lower the draw, you'll actually have a higher draw in the future. And I think that's, to me, that's an inspiration for saving if you're trying to do something for the generations of Alaskans going forward.
So just quick follow-up. So you don't have the number then?
Not for like what if we – I can do it, but I can't do it that quickly.
I'd love to see it.
Okay.
If you could. Thank you.
Representative Hannon, then Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. I want to just go back to page 32 and 33, where you're comparing the historical 5% and the historical 4.5, and looking at 2024 and the difference in the ERA. Just help me understand why it changes so much in 2024 when the rest of the years, comparing the two slides, seems pretty static to each other.
Mr. Allen.
It's entirely driven by the fact that under the 4.5% draw, the ERA is substantially larger going into 2024. So, again, remember we're inflation-proofing on top of taking out the money. And if you take out less, your market value gets larger, and you're realizing more statutory net income. And it's sort of a virtuous cycle, where you get more income, which creates a more healthy ERA. One of the other things I want to say about the two-account system that if I'd hate to be in your shoes because of this dynamic, okay? And it's important for this simulation. When this simulation started, the practice back in the late 90s and early 2000s was to keep the ERA as small as possible. Pay the dividend. We'll have plenty of statutory net income next year. Don't leave anything in there because the legislature is going to get their hands on it and spend it, right? That was the mantra. I heard it a million times. So they would drain the ERA through these ad hoc appropriations down to almost zero sometimes and just trust it was going to work. And then worst case scenario, you just don't pay a dividend, which would have been a disaster politically. But so we're starting here at a point in time when the ERA was kind of as fragile as it gets. Right now, I think we're sitting on an ERA of, I don't know what it is, $12 billion or something like that. It's big. The healthier the ERA, the less of a burden the two-account system is. Okay? If you can have a two-account system and a 4.5% draw or a 5% draw, and if you're sitting on a big old ERA at the beginning, there's very few scenarios where you're not going to be able to pay the draw. But because of the way the statute works, my understanding is that a 50% vote could basically take whatever's in the ERA and spend it all in 1 year. And so there's this kind of – the people that are looking out for the future are saying, well, we should take the money out of the ERA and put it over into inflation proofing and maybe even do some extra appropriations, right, because that protects the corpus. But then what it does is it makes the draw vulnerable because there's not the padding in there that when the market goes down and the statutory net income goes down, that you can weather the storm. So the safest thing for the state that needs the draw is to keep the ERA as big as possible and kind of just mentally inflation-proof, but don't actually move it, right? But then that creates the risk, right? So to me, the solution is just to fix the draw and make that, like, non-negotiable.
You mean down to 4.5%?
Either 4.5, yeah. 5, whatever it is, just fix it. Don't fix it at 6. All right. Yeah. I think 4.5 is more sustainable.
Okay. I think we're on Representative Bynum. Did you get your question?
I did, but I guess I just have one. Which, when you say fix it, you mean have it set in statute, which it is.
Correct.
5% draw.
Or less.
Right.
I got some shaking no and some shaking yes.
Coach Joseph.
So could you expand on what you mean by fix it compared to what our current policy and statute is?
Okay. I may be completely overstepping my knowledge of Alaskan politics here, but bear with me. my understanding is that statute could change with a majority vote. Correct?
Yes.
So it's not fixed. So what I mean by fixed is a constitutional fix. All right? 5% constitutional, 5% of the first 5 years of the last 6, or 4.5%. And because I feel like the statute is kind of dependent on who's sitting here and how bad things are. Mm-hmm. Right? They could get a lot worse. You're sitting like on the best permanent fund I've ever seen. 2008, I can tell you, it was tough to be a trustee. It was tough to be a consultant. You guys weren't relying on the draw, so it just reduced the dividend, which wasn't great, but, you know, Alaskans are tough. But, you know, imagine what would happen if suddenly instead of getting $3.8 billion, you're getting $1.7 billion or whatever it is for the state budget. You know, schools would close. I mean, it'd just be a disaster, right? So I think, and I don't think that would happen. I think there would be some change to the statute. But if the ERA is gone, you can't do anything. So then you'd have to get the two-account system changed to a one-account system. But maybe there'd be enough will at that point to get a constitutional change. I don't know. I mean, they've been talking about doing a constitutional change. I remember back in 2002, 2003, there was a big push for this. And ultimately, they pulled back because they didn't think they could get the votes. So it's hard. So anyway, that's my view, at least, on what the difference between fixed and in statute means.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair. Obviously, when we look at these, you didn't take into consideration any kind of statutory budget reserve or constitutional budget reserve, and so
correct.
This is just purely assuming that there's no other savings to be able to pull a draw from. And so
correct.
I know that's not really what you're trying to present, but I'm just wanted to make a point that this doesn't take into consideration any other smoothing factors that we might have available to us.
Correct.
And then as a comment, I guess, is that maybe if we treated an overdraw of the ERA a lot like we do a draw from a CBR, you wouldn't be able to see that 50% plus one vote to be able to just drain this thing out.
Right.
So
okay.
With all of that, my question really is have you looked at what the impacts would be for doing, I mean, I know you put a 6%, for example, in there, but taking like one large chunk draw from the ERA and what kind of a dramatic impact that would have long term to the fund?
Mr. Allen. I can speculate just based on having run the model. You know, if you take a big chunk out of the ERA and you have a bunch of good years afterwards and it builds back up again, then it's fine. It is going to reduce the draw permanently relative to what you would have drawn if you hadn't taken the chunk out. So you're kind of giving up some of the future for the present. So it kind of depends on how big it is going in, how big it is relative to the size of the ERA, and then what happens immediately after. If you take a big chunk out and you have five bad years in a row, you know, you're going to have to pay the piper at some point. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Galvin.
I pass. Thanks.
Any other Representative Stapp?
Yeah,
if this was a class, you've got a very captive audience.
Thank you, Coach Rock. Just permission to dialogue. I got about three or four quick questions.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. So for starters, thanks. I think this is a really good discussion that we should have. So my first question was, you had mentioned something that really piqued my interest. You talked about back in the day, since you've been looking at our permit for a long time, people would basically take appropriations. I mean, we call this inflation proofing, but obviously you're right. This is a numbers distinction. We transfer money because we can't touch the money when we transfer it. So that we call it that, but there is no material reason to do that other than hide it from ourselves. So how many times has, in your time, like before the legislature took draws on a POMB, I mean, how many times did we just additionally inflation proof to drain out the ERA through the chair?
Mr. Allen.
Since 1999, I think is where I'm just picturing my model. There were three in that period between about 2000 and 2005. The first one was $835 million. I remember that. And the other ones were more in the $200 or $300 million range. But those were ad hoc draws.
Ad hoc, not draws, ad hoc.
Ad hoc appropriations to principal, sorry.
Yeah. In the fault, Mr.
And there's been two $4 billion appropriations in the last 6 years. Right?
And again, if you were to do that, the effect is basically to lower the amount available. Back then, it was to lower the amount available to distribute PFDs.
Right.
Right. So that was the impact. So the impact was by doing that, legislature basically lowered the amount of dividend that you could pay because the funds weren't available in the ERA.
The dividend was always met. So they didn't lower it. And the reason that it was met is because the statutory net income was much larger than the dividend draw. So it just took one more year to make sure there was enough to pay the dividend, short of a 2009 type of scenario. So I think the thinking back then was we're going to be fine covering the dividend. We just don't want to leave any extra in there because the legislature could theoretically appropriate it for something else besides the dividend.
If those appropriations weren't made, would you have had money to pay a dividend in 2009?
Mr. Allen.
Probably. Maybe not under the 6%, but I think under the 5%, I'd have to look at that. But you would have had about another – well, so let me back up. Those were the ad hocs, and there were a whole bunch of inflation-proofing appropriations that happened before 2009 as well. You're saying take those off the table as well? You'd had plenty.
Yeah, and continuing on, I'm going to shift gears here, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up. Step for Mr. Allen.
Yeah, thank you to Mr. Allen. So on the topic of the drawing, so I agree with you. It's kind of like it's a bit of a double-edged sword here. So the responsible thing to do would be have a very robust balance in the ERA because that basically limits the amount of pressure that you'd have on a draw because there's plenty of available money there. The problem is if we rewind the clock back to, say, 2008, and I know you were managing funds back then, how would you have felt if you had $12 billion that you were readily able to cover investment losses like we are having that pot of money through the chair?
Mr. Allen.
Through the chair, can you rephrase that question?
I'm not sure exactly. This is hypothetical because obviously the pressure that we have is if things go poorly, there's a very large pot of money for us to be able to appropriate to fix quickly, yeah. Right? And, you know, this is a kind of benefit now to punish later kind of business. So yeah. if we were to take the draw and combine that and structure that in a way where we were basically limited ourselves, because that's what we're talking about here. Right. So if we were the most disciplined people on earth, we could have $80 billion in the ERA and we'd never have to worry about anything.
Yep.
But clearly we are not because we are elected right. officials. so my question really is, if I were to structure a draw that I would constitutionally protect, would I use a 4.5% number and fixed in the current rolling average that we use, or would I look at something like a real rate return over a longer period of time? Like, what is the most fiduciary kind of responsible way to structure something like that that's similar to other endowments, Sir Chair?
Mr. Allen.
Okay. I think the fixing the formula, I don't think a real return formula, we don't see that, right? Because that introduces a whole bunch of inflation volatility potentially. So most of what we see is somewhere between a 5% and a 4.5% draw of a 5-year moving average. So you're pretty close, but I would say if we look at the endowment community is the most alike to you guys, at least in the U.S. There are sovereign wealth funds around the globe, but in the U.S., these big college endowments are the most similar. And there's a study called the Nakubo study that goes out and surveys everybody and what are your draw rates. And so the average draw rate is about 4.6%, 4.7%. Steve just looked this up for me. And I think the reason for that is that there's some of them are at 5 and some of them are at 4.5. So that's kind of where the consensus is as to what's a sustainable draw. Again, if you pick 5, eventually 4.5 is going to eclipse 5, and you'll end up with more money coming out of the system.
Thank you. Yeah, follow up, Mr. Kutcher. Thank you.
Yes, follow up. We'll press on.
Yeah.
Rep step.
Yeah, thank you. So a lot of people, when we discuss this, they use kind of terminology of if we were to fix the draw, they're afraid that the draw rate would diminish the overall value of the fund over time. So the terminology they use is we would eat the seed corn because right now there's a constitutionally protected portion that we can't touch and not. So like in your experience as investors, if you take a smaller draw, and it's kind of fiduciarily in line with standard kind of endowment practices. Do you see that often in endowments, that the draw rates diminish the overall value of the fund if they're conservative through the chair?
Mr. Allen.
Over the long run, they do not, as long as they're scaled properly. In the short run, there are going to be periods where it's going to look like that, right? So, and it's not just the draw that's eating the principal, it's the return. These big negative returns are going to look – I mean, in 2008, technically, the return ate into the principal. Okay, the principal was below, the value was below the principal amount at that point in time. So the two-account system doesn't stop that from happening if you have a bunch of bad returns. You can eat through all the ERA, and then suddenly any more losses are just eating into principal. You're not protected now. Principal is like it's a fictitious number. It's an accounting number. It doesn't, I mean, I know it's kind of a sacred cow in the state of Alaska, and it's going to be a huge communication effort to get people over that. But the way you protect the corpus is by choosing a draw rate that's sustainable. It's like a fishery or a forest, right? You could take it all out in 1 year and you'd have no more years, right? There's a sustainable yield. And in our industry's opinion, that's about 4.5%.
And a last follow-up, Mr.
Last follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Adrisson. I appreciate that. And I think it's important to kind of let people know that, hey, the market itself was our seed corn eater when the market collapsed in 2008 because it did reduce the principal of the fund. So my last question is really simple. You guys have worked with a lot of funds. So let me just give you a simple one. Over the last 30 years, you have an endowment fund, and the draw rate is 4.5% or less. Are those funds have more capital value today with a conservative draw or less, through the chair?
Mr. Allen. They have more, and it's if it's 4.5%, they would have more on an inflation-adjusted basis, right? So a 4.5% draw with an asset allocation like the permanent fund over the last 30 years, the corpus would have grown by more than inflation.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Judge Josephson. Through the chair, Mr. Allen. So right now we had a real quick conversation about eating into the seed corn, as they say, or the corpus of the fund. But my understanding of the way that the fund is currently structured is that we only have about $59 billion, I think, that's actually part of the corpus. Then we've got another chunk that's about $20 billion that's unrealized gains. And then we have the ERA. And even part of the ERA is unrealized gains because that was gains – or I'm sorry – that was that's not really accessible unless you liquidated that in some way. Right. So the models that we're putting here is basically taking all of the money that we currently have and then fixing it at the 4.5%. So when I hear the term, we're going to eat into the seed corn, is that even a realistic possibility to get down and eat into the $60 billion corpus with the 4.5% or even a 5% or even a 6% draw? Is that even something that would even be practically without devastation of complete markets and like the world is on fire kind of thing?
Right. Like I mean, COVID, is it even possible? Example. Yeah, through the chair, generally speaking, it's a 5% probability type outcome, but it's 100% that it's going to happen at some point, right? In any given year, it's a 5% chance. But if you look back at 2008, I think by the end of the year, I mean, it's hard for me to do this mental math because the permanent fund's on a fiscal year basis, okay? So I don't exactly remember what the return was, 6/30/2009. So it kind of, again, it just depends on the time period. But I know that in December of 2008, the principal was underwater, okay? The losses were so big that and the ERA was relatively small at that point, and the unrealized gains were already really small. So the principal, it went below that, in this case, $59 billion number just because of the losses in the fund. So that is still possible, even with the fund at $80 billion and the ERA, or $90 billion and the ERA at $60 billion. If we had a 35% down year, you wouldn't even have $59 billion left, right? So you would have eaten into the seed corn. But that's just the nature of long-term investing. It comes back. And the nice thing about this formula is that year, if it happens to bottom on June 30th, that's locked into your 5% average for the next, you know, not that first year, but then the next 5 years, it lowers your draw. And so it naturally kind of heals itself over time. And people reset, and that's the beauty of that system, is it adjusts to those down markets. Not 100%, you don't take all the pain, but you take it over time that allows you to build back up to where you were.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. I appreciate your careful answers, and of course it makes sense to withdraw less from your savings account so that the compounding interest can continue to grow and create a sense of safety. I appreciate seeing all of these graphs that clearly articulate that. Also wanted to comment that over the last 25 years, what I'm seeing is that with a 5% draw, we are still seeing our value of this fund increase. Is that a good assessment?
Mr. Allen.
Yeah. Yes. The value of the fund, if you had taken out 5% since 2001, following the formula, so it's actually a little less than that, the value of the fund would have increased to roughly by the rate of inflation. Mm-hmm. So instead of getting all the way to $85 billion, you got to, I don't exactly remember the number, but
we're at 90.
We're at 90 now.
90, yeah.
Yeah, so what is it, the 5% draw number, that one at the top? I can't see what
66, 68.
So it'd be like today, if it's 68 at the end of 2025, so you'd be up at about 73 instead mm-hmm. of 90. So you'd have given up about $17 billion by having a 5% draw.
Understand. Everything is about what you're going to give up for dipping into your savings. Appreciate that. I understand that the Mental Health Trust Fund is something that you also are helping to invest or help them to invest their money accordingly, and that they've changed recently to have a different draw. Is that true?
Steve works on that.
Yeah, through the chair. Steve
Center
from
Center.
Yes, I work with the Mental Health Trust. The Mental Health Trust, up until last year, their draw rate was 4.25%, so 4.25%. As I'm sure you all know, the Mental Health Trust invests primarily in the permanent fund, so about 90% of their assets are invested in the permanent fund, 93-ish percent. Mm-hmm. They do have additional assets invested with the Department of Revenue that is managed just in a – think of that as like a liquidity portfolio, because it's easier to use that than to pull money from the permanent fund.
Sure.
And that's just invested in stocks and bonds, fully liquid stocks and bonds. They have a lower draw rate, and part of that is because they do generate income from their lands. So the lands themselves, in our forward projections, and this comes from information from the Trust Land Office, generate about $10 million on an annual basis. So that is in addition to the draw rate. Okay, so when you see the Mental Health Trust draw rate at 4.5%, mm-hmm. that is strictly the draw from permanent fund plus Department of Revenue. There's additional income coming from the lands. So that increases the amount that they have, a spendable rate that they can spend. And so,
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Follow up. So is that, so what my understanding is that they've increased then
they increased, correct, from 4.25 to 4.5%
correct.
Last
and
year.
Was that based on advice from Callan, or was that a board decision without any advice from you?
That Mr. Was, Center.
Through the chair, thank you. That was based on advice from Callan. We recommended initially that they actually increase to 4.75 to 5%, a higher increase. The board, with our help, decided to lower the risk profile of the Department of Revenue assets that are invested outside of the permanent fund to kind of take some risk off the table. And in conjunction with that decision, they decided to increase just from 4.25 to 4.5%. Kind of a stepwise increase is a good way to look at it. They, in our opinion, they could weather a higher draw rate up to as high as 5%. Instead, they've decided to lower the risk profile of the Department of Revenue assets slightly, and also take into account, as we mentioned, that revenue that gets generated from the land assets. So that ultimately supports that 4.5% draw that they landed
on. Okay, thank you.
Year.
I appreciate this context. I would also at some point be curious to see what you had shown. You jumped from 5 to 6 and not the 5.5. And I see, you know what I mean? Typically, you've gone from 4.5 to 5, and then you jumped all the way up to 6. The reason I bring this up is that this is policy calls, of course, and I know that you appreciate that we're all trying to evaluate how to be careful and then also how to make sure that we're you know, taking care of our roads and kids and hospitals and all of that. So it is a balance that we're trying to find, and I appreciate you having this conversation, especially in light of our current constraints. So thank you very much for being here.
Let's hit the accelerator again.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to see what I can do here. So the rest of these charts, up, and I'm going to get to the very last two because I think they're interesting as well, but I'm going to just... I have a model. It's a Monte Carlo model. It simulates the future. So now we're talking about the future. We use our capital market projections. We're looking out in the future. I'm starting from the point of now when you have a big, healthy ERA balance, and I'm just looking at, you know, what would happen in the future. What is, and now, because we're talking about the future, I can give you a range of outcomes, but I can't tell you exactly what could happen because if I could, that'd be pretty cool. But so, all right. So the way this model works is I simulate capital market returns in each year for 10 years. This is the range of returns in each year that the permanent fund will likely experience between the 5th percentile and 95th percentile. So you can see they're relatively similar each year, but they have a wide range. So you could have a return in the permanent fund up to about 25%, and you could have a return of, you know, down to about minus 7% in any given year. That's kind of the 5th through 95th percentile. So that's the foundation on which this set of simulations is landing. So given that range of return, this is the range of the statutory return, statutory net income. So I wanted to get across the point that the return is super volatile, but statutory net income, it comes from coupons, from bonds, it comes from dividends, it comes from real estate income, and it comes from the realization of capital gains, which is kind of a regular sort of a thing as you're doing. So statutory net income is much more stable than return. So that's the only reason I put that in there. Well, I'd also say that it averages in our, in, you know, around 6 to 6.5% is kind of the median expectation in any given year. All right. That's the distribution in dollars. Okay, so I'm simulating out. So when you see those low ones, those down there at the 5th percentile, those are bad outcomes in the stock market, the bond market, et cetera. Those are likely situations where you couldn't meet the draw because the ERA kicked in. Okay, that's typically what triggers the bad outcomes. All right. I'm going to show you now statutory net income in dollar terms. So that was percentage before. And these little dots, I'm going to keep these distribution dots on there so you can see the scale of the distributions relative to the statutory net income. So you see that? You got to like watch it flip back and forth. Maybe, Steve, can you hit those two arrows a couple times just to get the point across? Yeah, and then go up. Okay, you can see that statutory net income, it was very narrow relative to the return, but the distribution is even narrower relative to statutory net income, and it's mostly in the bottom half. So what I'm saying is, even with a 5% draw, as long as you don't raid the ERA, this system is likely to be pretty stable, and you'll be able to meet those draws. It's only going to be in like 10% of the cases where you're not going to be able to do it. This is, again, going forward. Oh, sorry, is there a question?
Representative Galvin for
thank you. I just
Mr.
have
Allen.
A very quick question. I'm curious to know, given the current, what feels like turbulent times in the marketplace because of maybe what feels like a lot of decisions politically, have you changed any of this based on maybe outlook for the next few years? Or, you know, I just know that what I read, what you showed us earlier was outside of U.S. Seems to be doing great for whatever reason. Right. So I just wondered if there was any insight on that and if that is shown here.
Mr. Yeah. Allen.
Through the chair. Ironically, we go through this process every year where we look out and say, is it different from last year and how is it different and let's change our expectations. In my 30 years of being involved with this, this is the first time we actually didn't change our expectations from last year. And, you know, partly that's they ride on top of inflation, and we don't see anything about inflation that's going to be that different. They ride on top of GDP. So there are these kind of big global effects. They're 10-year numbers, so nothing usually changes in 1 year that has that big of an effect. So even when we do change, it's relatively small. But yeah, this was a year where, in spite of all the turmoil and the confusion and everything else that's going on, we kind of stuck with the numbers. And you know, so that's our view. As you can tell, I showed you that we're right most of the time, but not always.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So those are the inflation-proofing appropriations. That's the range. You can see that once you get out to about 2031, there's a 25% chance that you won't be able to make any. It'd be a zero in that year, and then from there on. So again, this is with the 5% draw. Like I said, if you have a 5% draw, you're going to be able to beat CPI plus 5 about half the time, and half the time you're not. And so in this model, what takes the hit when you can't make it all is inflation proofing. I pay the draw, and if there's anything left over, I inflation proof in the model. So that shows you that if you want to maintain purchasing power and you want to have a better than 75% chance of doing it, this draw is probably a little too high. All right. There's the market values. So again, using our median numbers, you'll eclipse $100 billion in 2032, but we're already at 90. So, and by the way, this simulation started back in June. I do these always from the beginning of the fiscal year, so it doesn't take into account the really good year. It's half a year that we've already had.
So the fund value has increased $5 billion in 2 months.
Yeah.
6 months. Since June of 2025 till December of 2025.
Okay.
Correct. The value as of the end of December 2025, and this includes the full permanent fund balance, so that includes the mental health trust as well. It's north of 90, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's your range of principal balance. The thing that drives the difference between the high and the low is not the lack of inflation proofing. It's just the range of inflation outcomes in the simulation. So there are high inflation outcomes and you have to put a bunch in, and there's low inflation outcomes where you don't put much in. So I talked about, this is the slide where I can't quite show it, but this is the median draw, and I'm comparing 4, 5, and 6% draws. So of course the 6% draw is always, the first 2 years are already locked in. You already know what they're going to be, so I didn't change those. But after that, I went to 6, and I went to 5. I kept 5, and I went to 4.5. And I guess what I kind of wanted to be able to show you is, you see how the blue line is getting closer to the orange line?
Mm-hmm.
That's because the market value is getting higher under the blue line than under the orange line. And like I said, about year 12 is where they are equal. So I think that's a really important, if you want to show the benefit of saving for the future, obviously it's going to be more money in the future, but it's also a bigger draw in the future. So then I have a whole bunch of charts that compare 4.5, 5, and 6. Those are the range of distributions, statutory net income. You know, the 6% draw in 2035 is going to have a lower statutory net income than the 4.5% draw, just because there's a bigger corpus to generate income. So all of these are kind of getting across the same point. This is just showing the probability of not being able to do all of the inflation proofing year by year. And it's obviously higher the higher the draw. All right. This is my last two slides. Before I came up here, there was a question I think might have been posed to Devin or somewhere. What if we had a rule where it's a 5% draw, but there was an override that says if the fund didn't generate 5% return, you couldn't pay the full draw. You could only pay what the fund returned. So I went back and looked at the history of the fund, and I looked at, well, it could be a 5% return over the 1 year, or maybe it's the 3 year is the rule, or maybe the 5 year is the rule, or maybe the 10 year is the rule. But I went back and looked at how many years you wouldn't have been able to pay the full draw based on all those different rules. So if you wanted to have an overlay that's kind of like a prudent overlay, that might be one. And it turns out there were really only 2 years where the draw would have been limited. But again, this is 5% nominal. This isn't real. This doesn't take into account inflation proofing, right? If the rule was you had to generate 5% real after inflation, that's what the chart looks like. So you'd add a lot of years. None of them are negative. I mean, if you look at the 10 years, But you can see the draw. If you said you could only pay out what you earned on a real basis over the previous 10 years, you can see there'd be a lot of years that would be substantially below 5%. So anyway, I think that's it for that.
Co-Chair Schrage for Mr. Allen.
Is it a proper takeaway to say that the five-year column is the most comparable to our current structure, where we take the five-year average of the fund? Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, it's pretty close. That's what the five-year return would have been. I mean, yours is the first five of the last six, but it's going to be, you know, apples to apples.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
And one takeaway from this is that this would not be a good structure if you're concerned about the ability to provide services to Alaskans in a stable fashion, because some years you just have no ability to draw from the fund, essentially.
That's correct. That's correct. The only other thing I would say is that it's also designed to show you that the longer the look back, the less volatile the rule is going to be.
Mr. Allen, I know you've got a slide on this somewhere. $12 billion in the ERA, a proposed $1.5 billion inflation-proof appropriation. Is that advisable?
Yeah, I think that's not going to be the difference in the end when you hit a bad year. I think that's a reasonable. If it was only $1.5 billion in the ERA and you were going to appropriate it all, I'd say keep it in there. At one point under a previous board, there was an attempt to come up with a formula for the size of the ERA relative to the size of the draw and sort of say, here's the safety zone. Practically speaking, that might be an interesting intellectual exercise, which we could certainly do, but it's not really within your control that you're in that zone or not. If everybody was disciplined, I would say keep the ERA as big as you possibly can. It's a pretty clumsy instrument with dire consequences to use it as a deterrent from taking the money, right?
Okay. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair, just really quick. And I know most this presentation is really only to talk about how things would perform. There has been the discussion about a single fund. And other than trying to provide this guardrail against raiding the ERA, is there any investment strategy to being able to have the access to the one fund structure as opposed to a two fund structure with a very healthy ERA?
No.
No. Oh, good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. This has been very helpful. We enjoy your visit. We did last year. Anything else the presenters want to add?
I think we... Nope, we're good. Mic drop.
Can I ask one additional question?
Yes, Co-Chair Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Probably a question that I should know the answer to, but I just hadn't thought of it until today. How is most endowments don't have a revenue stream being injected into it each year, right? You just have the investment itself, which is generating a return, and then there's a sustainable draw taken off of that. How are royalties and continued deposits into the fund taken into account when you're presenting in return to us and evaluating the performance?
So,
Mr. Allen.
Yeah, the royalties don't affect the performance, right? They just affect the market value, so their contributions. The royalties are, I think, in the range of $300 or $400 million a year on an $80 billion fund, so they're not making a big difference anymore. And then on the comment, but then all this modeling I'm assuming. Whatever our best projection is from whoever projects that up here. On the question about endowments, though, most college endowments have pretty robust fundraising efforts, so they are actually going out every year and pulling in donors and parents of kids that went to college there and everything else. So they do have income that goes beyond just what the endowment creates. I think Yale and Harvard in particular pull in like hundreds of millions of dollars that way every year. So,
gotcha. And just a concluding comment. So the takeaway from that is that your growth of the fund would just be ever so slightly higher than your actual rate of return on the fund.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, President Bynum, one question, then I have to adjourn. One question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And just as a quick follow-up, and obviously when we're looking at Mr. Allen, so when we were looking at the what-ifs, we had this scenario of what actually happened in real life, and then we had the what if it was 5%, what if it was 4.5%. Those what-ifs obviously didn't take into consideration other revenues coming to the state, like oil revenues or royalties, and they also didn't take into it didn't obviously demonstrate that there was a that there is this differential between what was actually taken. So I believe it was like about a $4 billion difference of what we actually took versus what the model said we would have taken. And then if you look at the value of the fund, that the, you know, we showed a lower value of the fund.
Right.
That's because we actually didn't take the $4 billion. It stayed in, correct?
Right. So because the $4 billion stayed in, the fund grew by a lot more than $4 billion. So I think it's like $20 billion or $17 billion or something like that. And in that past simulation, I think you were saying I wasn't taking into account the revenue that was coming to the state, but I was taking into account the revenue that came into the fund.
Correct.
So,
Thank you. Okay. I want to thank our presenters, CEO Allen, CFA Center, for their help today. That concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 25 at 9 a.m. At that meeting, we will again take up House Bill 91, Marijuana Tax, Retail Stores, and Registration. Change of subject there. With that, we will gavel out at 3:26. Thank you.